But first, as I said before the news, what a pleasure it is to laugh when you're reading a work of Canadian fiction. And this is not to splash terrible, awful paint on all sorts of other books, but we do have a certain quality of earnestness, I would say, and care, and compassion, and there's a lot of historical fiction out this season. So it was a great pleasure to read The Nine Planets, which is Ed Rich's new novel. And if you have ever been plunged into despair on a bleak wintry day by a certain kind of moody and restrained canlit, get a copy of this book. Ed lives in St. John's, but unlike many of his contemporaries, his books aren't about Newfoundland's past. The Nine Planets is set in a private school. At its heart is a middle-aged misanthrope who is vice principal to the offspring of the St. John's hoity-toity. Ed Rich joins me from St. John's. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Sheila.
And on the weekend, I learned that I would be speaking to an underrated Canadian writer.
I read that, and I've been using it
in the Globe and Mail.
I've been using it around the house a lot.
That I'm underrated.
In the domestic sphere. I've been saying, here I go, underrated again.
Again.
Supper was very, cooked supper last night, but, you know, and they ate every morsel, and yet, you know, I didn't hear anything, so underrated.
So, in fact, it was a gift from the Globe and Mail.
Yes.
Isn't that nice?
Well, the alternative is bad. Being overrated.
Well, yes, it is. I imagine.
Yeah.
I hope I keep imagining it anyway.
Someday I'll be overrated.
I hope you're never overrated. God knows. Okay, now listen, this idea for a novel about intrigues at a private school. How did it enter your head?
It's funny. It got started it was a direct connection from a conversation to the book. I was had a dinner party, and a good buddy of mine was stuck around afterwards, and we were drinking. And I think we were both at that place in our lives where we were considering, you know, having a family. And somehow the talk turned to educating your offspring. And he insisted that had he the resources, he would always give his son or daughter the best education, and that would be, in to his mind, in a private setting, Winchester, I think he was thinking, in England. Mm. And I, being an unrepentant socialist, thought that, no, you should participate in the public system, whether you had the money to put your kid in the best quote-unquote, private school or not. And then I just started thinking about it. And the times were such that unrepentant socialists like myself were becoming antiques, you know? And so that sort of, that notion, rather than being like write a polemic or a screed, I created a character who gave voice to ideas completely in opposition to my own.
And do you think that private schools, as a habit, take advantage of parents' insecurity about their children?
Well, they certainly did in the case of, say, the George Bushes and people like that. I was just reading he went to Phillips Andover, the current president of the United States, where they, I guess, taught him to be president of the United States. But I think, yeah, they do. And I think these days, too, there's a lot of... now they prey on kids that, well, every kid's special, of course. You know, Marty in this book acknowledges that everyone's child is special. And so they obviously need special treatment.
This is Marty, the misanthrope.
Yeah, I guess people say that. But I mean, he's kind of misanthropic. He's kind of nasty. But
I liked him.
Oh, good. You know who like him? Women.
Oh, now what does that
I mean,
say
not,
about
not
women?
Not in that way. But because he gives voice to dark thoughts about family,
yes,
and
kids,
children,
yeah,
and love within the family, he's saying all kinds of things that are utterly taboo, I think, mm-hmm, for women.
They're probably pretty taboo for a vice principal of a high school, too,
yes,
right?
Well, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah, but such as?
Well, that, I don't know.
Oh, okay, for example, I've got all these
got
little
them?
Notes about,
okay,
you know, page this and that. Here we go, page 82, about halfway down, I've noticed a certain disgust for teenagers. Okay.
Oh, yes.
All right, would you like me to read this?
Sure, please.
Okay, well, actually, you know what, you could, too.
82?
Yeah, page 82. I think if you talked... you'd have to set this up a little bit, because he's just gone off into the forest and has found all sorts of things carved into the bark of the trees.
Yes. He's noticed from a window in the school that a grove of trees, little copse at the back of the soccer pitches, seems to be inexplicably thinning out. And
yeah.
He walks out to investigate. And
really, all you need to read is two sentences, which go like this. He felt rising in himself a sentiment he consciously and daily gnawed against like a bit in his teeth, a disgust for teenagers. So there you are. And isn't he in the perfect place?
Yes. Yeah. I guess it gives the book some energy, I guess, that a man who hates teenagers finds himself as the vice principal of a high school.
Rather nice. Are there any schools like the Red Pines around St. John's?
No, it's totally a fictional creation. There are a couple of parochial outfits, and there's a private school that's sort of a co-op. A mercantile venture like the one in the book doesn't exist. Although I see profit opportunities, you know. This, I guess, is... he's making a UCC in a box,
yeah,
is what Marty's doing. We don't have those kind of schools here quite yet, but, you know, there's a boom here, so... It's next, you know.
And you've imagined beyond that, Ed, moving into a franchise school like this. Why not?
Yeah, and surfaces are important, you know, to people. They want things to seem a certain way, and Marty realizes that, and he understands how to dress a school to make it seem venerable. He invents tradition.
Yeah.
Very, very... that's his greatest skill, actually, is to give the appearance of venerability.
Where do you think his little edge comes from? I mean, as we said, I think we do like him because he will actually, if he's not speaking the truth, he's certainly thinking it,
yes,
or thinking thoughts that we dare not voice.
Mm-hmm.
He's very observant of the people around him and quite brutal in his observations.
Yeah.
Where does all of that come from, that little stew inside Marty?
Well, he's, I think, too, when I had... This book got started soon after I had my first child. And you realize quickly that until you have a youngster, it's very hard to get over yourself. And they teach you that so fast. And Marty is certainly not over himself. He's childless in his middle years. And that can be, I think, kind of destructive to people. I don't think it always is. But he's hopelessly self-absorbed. And I think that's what's wearing on him. He's not spending enough time thinking about others.
I will not ask you this question. Question is this you? No, I'm not going to ask you this. But is there a character in The Nine Planets with whom you most identify?
I identify with his brother a bit.
Tell us about Rex.
Rex is a failed playwright.
Is he underrated?
He's underrated. He's underrated. He's overweight. And he's the grants are starting to dry up. I think he's realizing that he's something of an underachiever by his own standards. And he's finding a certain unhappiness with that. And in the end, he has I won't say what happens to him in the end.
Neither will I.
And he's, in many ways, everything that his brother Marty is not. He's, like me, sort of left-leaning. Unlike me, he's got a lot of hair. maybe that was wishful thinking. And I share some of the views held by his wife, Meredith, too.
Do you cook? Like Rex does?
Yes, I do. I'm a better cook than Rex.
Are you? Well, he's a pretty
underrated
good cook.
As a cook.
Underrated. There was a lot of food and rare birds, too, food and wine.
Yeah.
Nice thing to have in a book.
Yeah.
It's pleasure. That's
another
thing we don't get a lot of in a lot of Canadian stories.
Well, this is not like... I guess people should know that. It's not very Canadian. It's not sort of... doesn't fall, as you said, into the sort of can-lit domain because it's maybe more exuberant. I think that in many ways it's a good thing that a lot of Canadian prose is marked by a kind of restraint.
Not yours.
Measured and cautious. And no, I'm all out.
Damn the torpedoes.
Yeah, it's very colorful, and it's pretty fast-moving, and it's brash, but...
I think, as an example, this would be a good point to hear you read.
Okay. I'll read a bit from the from earlier in the book. And this is one of the teachers at Marty School, one he particularly dislikes, is a guy named Abe Summers, who is a writer, a novelist. And I've heard an awful lot of speculation as to who this person is. It's no one, in fact. He's a totally fictional creation. But it's amazing how certain people are. In a small town like St. John's, too, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody guesses that everybody's somebody else. And this was written...
Is that why so many writers write historical fiction coming out of St. John's?
I think that's sort of... The reason they write historical fiction here is because the place is chock-a-block with ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everywhere. You can't avoid it. And I think it's something that, I've done it. Actually, Peter Pope said to me that this book, in fact, since it's set in 1999, is historical fiction.
At the time of Columbine.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose it is.
And he pointed out, then he thought for a second, and he scratched his chin at the ship and said, I guess it's all historical fiction except for science fiction.
Well, there you go.
Right.
Now, there's
true,
a great
right.
point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, let me read this thing.
I will.
Here. And yeah, this was, I just learned that Wayne Johnson got one of these little sinecures down at some private school in the state, so it's got nothing to do with him.
Okay. That's a big disclaimer.
Yeah.
Here's Ed Rich reading.
Okay. Summers spent his time away from the school being a writer and intellectual. He tried being a wit, but couldn't pull it off. Sometimes he was a Newfoundland writer, sometimes a Canadian writer, sometimes a writer who didn't believe in those labels, all depending on the room. He gave readings, granted interviews, was a panelist on book chat shows, attended literary festivals, weighed in on anything to do with the arts, cinema, dance, music, whether he knew anything of the discipline or not. There was a one-time flirtation with journalism, guesting a drinks column in, of all things, a men's magazine. Summers' Ponzi Payan to the glories of the Vosne Romani was sandwiched between similarly faint hopes of a Lamborghini road test and an illustrated guide to some new techniques for pleasuring the babes. It all left scarcely any time for the book. Summers continued to contend that part of his function at the Red Pines was as a writer-in-residence. Before his stint at the Pines, Summers secured, how one could only imagine, just such a post at the achingly prestigious Phillips Exeter Prep School in New Hampshire. There, Marty inferred, Summers was able to indulge his cheever-esque vices and wax pretentious with like-minded New England puffs. The appointment gave Summers a pedigree Marty traded on. The new novel, working title The Anesthetist's Annual, had yet to appear.
That is Ed Rich reading a couple of paragraphs from his novel, The Nine Planets. I turned my mic off for you.
Okay.
Because I was gasping with laughter.
I last saw you at one of those literary festivals.
Oh, let's not talk about that.
I thought it was very fun, though.
Well, actually, it was. Let's talk about it, then. It was the Woody Point Writers' Festival, the first annual, right?
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Boy, I think people should pencil it in now, because it was a lot of fun.
I do.
Really, really was. And the setting was ridiculous. It was so beautiful.
Grossmorne Park.
I was driving down to the event one day, and I was ferrying Bernice Morgan, and we had to pull over on the side of the road to look down into the sound where porpoises were herding mackerel in this, and then like this spiral, and then gobbling them up. And when I went down to my reading, like Grossmorne was spotlit.
Yes.
The hole in the clouds, it looked like a big
glob.
That's
right, of honey. I remember that. The beautiful backlighting. It really was something. Bernice Morgan, I should say, the author of Random Passage and other things, of course.
Yeah, me and Bernice were kept in the writer's compound there, which was outside the community proper. I just wondered about that.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know.
That's very interesting.
Kept all the writers about a 20-minute drive away from everything.
Well, if we go back to your reading now, that public reading, not many writers choose to read dialogue out loud, but you did.
Yeah. Yeah, the best scene in the book, I think, my favorite scene has like four or five speakers and someone singing, so I can't really do that bit. But I do have a lot of dialogue, and I guess that comes from, you know, a lot of the work I've done in the cinema and for television
TV
and for radio. You know, I mean,
and of course.
Yeah, my first love is radio and doing, you know, drama slash comedy on the radio. So voiced dialogue has been something I've become familiar with.
I don't know what your favorite scene is. Is it? Do you have your book there?
I do have my book.
My favorite
scene is when his girlfriend Sophie's uncle Casper shows up and plays and there's a starlet in town and she can sing and they do a little impromptu performance at a party she's holding and I can't possibly read it because like I say there's singing in there and that's my favorite scene but there's a lot of dialogue there's a lot of banter in this book.
It moves. Ça bouge.
Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's not over yet, though, Ed. Sorry. I want to ask you about Kathy.
Yeah.
Tell us about Kathy.
She's a 16-year-old. I think the book, is unusual in that it has sort of twinned protagonists, one being Marty, the other being his 16-year-old niece, Kathy Ford Devereaux. And like many of the teenagers that Marty despises, you know, she's difficult and not very communicative with her parents and so on, but
she's this great walker too.
She doesn't tarry, I say in the book. She's just constantly moving to eat up the endless hours that she has to endure in her teen years. But I think, unlike many of the teenagers we see in fiction now, she's not. She has in the book certainly. We're concerned a lot with her intellectual life. As much as her emotional life,
mm-hmm.
And I think that's good. I think that teenagers can certainly be intellectual too. She has a burgeoning intellect and an intellectual curiosity, which we follow very closely in the book. I mean, and she's got all those other things too. She falls in love with a boy in school, and
she is a beautifully wrought character, I think.
Yeah, I worried.
You were concerned.
I worked hard on that, you know, and I thought I'll just be crucified.
But you weren't, were you?
No. I've had lots of compliments. The owner of a bookstore here in town said to me, "I didn't know you'd been a 16-year-old girl." And I said, "Well, you weren't around last weekend." I think I've been. I haven't had any complaints about it so far. And certainly no 16-year-olds have given me any grief.
I want to ask you, too, about... This is a story that's set in suburbia, right?
Sure is.
Yeah, and maybe not our first thought about St. John's, even.
No, but I grew up in the suburbs, and I...
Where, in Mount Pearl?
Suburbs. No, I grew up in the East End.
Mm-hmm.
I know nothing as unholy as Mount Pearl.
Well, just checking.
Here come the calls. I'm just getting eyes from the technicians.
Okay, and our email address is soundslikecanada@cbc.ca.
My brother lives in Mount Pearl, so... I spent a lot of time wandering the sort of the newer suburbs of the East End. And, you know, again, we wandered to eat up the time, and we got from place to place by walking there. And we found shortcuts and shunts and hideaways. And so we became very intimate with that kind of geography. And as much as I spent a lot of time in my youth, like, you know, in parts of Newfoundland that were still in the 17th century, you know, my folks up in the Great Northern or in Notre Dame Bay,
yeah.
I spent an awful lot of time in a suburban world that's very much like the one inhabited by most people my age, I guess, you know, the relatively new suburbs of the 60s in Canada.
Now, there's a conflict in the story between some businessmen, and they are businessmen, in case someone wants to write to me about business people.
Okay.
They are actually men in the story, mm-hmm. correct,
mm-hmm.
who want to develop a pristine piece of property on the city limits.
Yes.
And is that going on now, too? Is that the sort of thing that plays out in St. John's these days?
Yes, you see that a lot. It's not so much land that's at issue. I think everybody's sort of... boosting the development and any kind of economic activity here after so many years of deprivation. But a lot of it has to do with older buildings and so on, the preservation. There's a sort of constant tension here between sort of heritage-minded people and preservationists mm-hmm. and the develop-at-all-cost community. And it's really been, you know, it really has been in the news quite a bit. And when I was working on this book, there was all this talk about a development called the Southlands. And I don't even know where it is, but there was something about the sort of phonics of that or the music of that phrase that just, I don't know, I thought the Southlands is like something, you know, Clint Eastwood would star
in. There would have to be a racetrack in it or something.
Yeah, and it somehow made me, it drove me to write this book in a way. It was one of the things that was going on at the time. This book was nascent, you know.
One of the points that you make, though, is, well, one of the developers, I should say, makes a speech to Marty about how the people who settled Newfoundland Island, they didn't come for theater festivals or Woody Point or whatever,
no.
or whale watching or porpoise herding,
yeah.
Mackerel herding, but because of the money. There
yes.
is always an opportunity for money to be made.
That's right. They came to not to watch the whales, but to kill them and sell their fat.
Right.
Yeah, and that's and our you know the fishery that's central to the culture here is about money mostly, I worry that we forget that and we are trying to trap ourselves in amber. I agree with that sometimes in the book, and also in terms of development and stuff. I'd like to see some more modern architecture here, you know. I'd like to see a little less of the Victorian. It's starting to drive me nuts. I'd like to see...
Who do you want? Who do you want to come and design a...
I'm not that conversant with architecture. I know
yeah.
that... I love that thing in Bilbao that Frank Gehry did, the big shiny thing. But, I mean, I keep thinking they should find who the new, young, crazy, nutsy person is who
yeah.
wants to do something with some strange materials and build buildings out of that and put them right next to the Victorian buildings to make both of them more interesting, you know?
I would like... Well, that's, of course, what a relationship is.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Otherwise, why bother?
Yeah.
You know? Okay. Well, are you still... You're still writing for film and TV and radio?
Yeah, right now I'm doing a couple of story editing gigs, which is great because you get to see this new generation of people that... This town just pops up. I don't know where they keep coming from here.
It is amazing.
Yeah, I saw this sketch comedy thing last week called On the Nog, and it was side-splitting. And I was just saying, here's another, like, four lads getting ready to waste their lives in the arts in Canada. And they're so good that they're going to be at it. You know they're not going to, they're not going to find the time to do something else or actually study or get a job. And they're just going to be, I'm going to see them in 30 years shuffling down Water Street in the same pair of shoes they wore last night. But there's lots of talent here.
And you're doing stuff, and I have 30 seconds
stuff.
To hear about it.
Okay,
you're busy. You're
yeah,
employed,
I'm busy.
And
I'm
you're
busy.
Underrated.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you. Thanks.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you for the book. Merry Christmas to you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yes.
Thank you.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Edward Rich is the author of The Nine Planets. We didn't even talk about the title. Oh, well, it's in the book. It's published by Viking. You're listening to Sounds Like Canada on CBC Radio 1, and we'll be back in a minute and a half.